This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Blues legend B.B. King was born and raised in Indianola, Mississippi, and that southern city hasn't forgotten it. This weekend, the B.B. King Museum and Delta Interpretive Center has its grand opening, featuring artifacts from his 60-year career as a blues guitarist, composer, and singer. King, who is 83, is scheduled to perform Saturday on opening night, and on Sunday, there's a gospel and grits brunch. B.B. King has won 14 Grammys. He's traveled the world, met four presidents and a pope, and was named a living legend by the Library of Congress. Terry Gross spoke to B.B. King in 1996. She asked him how he developed his trademark style of playing single-note guitar as opposed to chords or rhythm.
Well, every time I've worked in a band, I was always featured. And they'd hardly let me play in the rhythm section. Usually, for some reason, most of the players would always say, B, take the solo, take the lead. And I got in the habit of doing that. So I put more emphasis on the single string than I did the chords. I can play a few chords, but I'm no great chord player. But, for example, if you were singing or playing, I could play chords pretty well behind you with a guideline. The guideline means if I had a bass player or keyboard player, somebody that's playing the chords, I could play then. I could play behind you very well. But other than that, I'm sad. Anybody hear me play by myself, I've just lost that person. You know, they won't listen to me anymore. That's the end.
So did you feel that your strength lay not in just being a guitar player or in just being a singer, but in doing both together?
I think both together. I started to feel that I, you know, had to be a good entertainer to keep a job, and I'm kind of happy that I developed in my head that I'm never any better than my last concert or my last time I played. So it's like an audition each time. Quite often, it's quite a bit like some say when you're going on stage, you have stage fright. In so many words, you get nervous just before going on stage, and I still have that, but I think it's more like concern. You're concerned about the people. It's like meeting your in-laws for the first time.
When I first got the blues, they brought me over on a ship. Men were standing over me, and a lot more with the whip. And everybody want to know why I sing the blues. Well, I've been around a long time. I've really paid my dues. I've laid in the ghetto flats, cold and numb. I heard the rats tell the bedbugs to give the roaches some. Everybody want to know why I'm singing the blues. Yes, I've been around a long time. People, I've paid my dues.
You're from a family of sharecroppers. What was the work that you had to do?
Well, I was a regular hand when I was about seven. I chopped cotton. I picked cotton. I helped to plant it. I did everything that the grown-ups do, and that's mostly the work what had to do with cotton was the king, if you will, of the produce in the Mississippi Delta when I was growing up. Peanuts maybe later, and soybeans later. But cotton still is today one of the main produces that's raised in the Mississippi Delta.
Now, what was the financial arrangement between your family and the plantation owner?
Well, a sharecropper was meant to be exactly what they say, sharecropper. But generally, the boss that owned the plantation did all of the paperwork, if you will. He was the CPA. he did all of that, and he sold the produce that you raised. For example, Jim, you earned, after paying me back the advances I gave you, you made 25 bales of cotton, and the cotton brought maybe $5,000 a bale, and you owed me, say, 25 times that, except maybe $2,000. So here's your $1,800.
You know what I'm wondering? When you were growing up on a plantation, family of sharecroppers, did you vow to yourself early on, I'm getting out of here?
Well, not really. Believe it or not, people lived on the plantation, felt like that this was really home, most of them. And we are being taken care of because the boss of the plantation usually was like your lawyer, your judge, your father, your mom. He was your practically everything. And people lived on the plantation, sort of felt, believe it or not, secure to be there. If they needed a few bucks, usually they could get this from the boss man, and it's taken out at the end of the year. At that time, we didn't have telephones. We didn't have electricity or anything of that sort. Later on, I guess we had electricity maybe a year or so before I left when I was 18 years old. A lot of the people, including myself, the early years, just thought that this was it. You know, this you raise your families and you get old, die, your families take over, kids and what have you, and it's an ongoing process, if you will. But I somehow later start to feel that there was more for me and a few others. I think it's the same way with young people today. They feel that they're not really happy with the status quo.
It's a great story how you left the plantation. You were driving a tractor. This was a problematic tractor that had it had problems with after ignition. So one day you turned off the tractor, walked out of the tractor, and then the tractor started jumping on its own, rammed into the barn. The exhaust pipe got crushed or, you know, broke off.
Broke off, yes.
And you were afraid of how much money you'd owe the plantation owner.
No, I was afraid that I would be killed.
Oh, even worse.
No. Well, he'd never kill anybody, but he, I don't mean it that way, but scared to death. You know, like if you, your mom cooked a cake and you decided that, you know, you're going to get a piece of it and you drop it, you know, and it spills on the floor. Brand new cake that's made for the family, you would feel that mom is going to surely kill you, so you better get out of there. Well, that's the way I felt that the time that the tractor, when it backfired, you know, and ran out into there. It scared me half to death. So I panicked and left, hitchhiked to Memphis. Going from Indianola to Memphis then was like, to me, like leaving Chicago, going to Philly. It was that far. That's the way it seemed at the time. So I was scared to death. I left and stayed for a while and communicated back with my family and my cousin Booker White. Said, go on back there and take your medicine. So I finally went back, and Mr. Barrett was a very nice guy, a man that I admired so much. I wished I could be a lot more like him.
Now, I want to get to another record recorded in 1952. You were 26. This is a recording of 3 o'clock Blues. It had been a hit a few years before for Lowell Folsom.
Right.
This was your first number one record on the R&B charts.
Very first.
You're coming into your own here, don't you think, as a stylist?
I'm a very happy guy to know that somebody tells me that I have a hit record. I was very happy to hear that. I think that's music to each performer's ear to hear that they have a top-selling record or CD.
Let's hear it.
Now here it is, 3 o'clock in the morning. Can't even close my eyes. Well, I can't find my baby. Lord, and I can't be satisfied.
That's B.B. King, recorded in 1952. How did that record, your first record, went to number one on the R&B charts, change your life?
Well, it changed my life in many ways. One thing, financially, because I had been making about $60 a week at this radio station. And I would go out and pick cotton. I would drive trucks and tractors. I did everything to try to make ends meet, if you will, because my music wasn't taking care of me. And when I made 3 o'clock Blues, I started then to get guarantees, maybe like $400 or $500 a day when I played out. And that made a big difference, as far as financially speaking, because then I could hire more people to work with me, made life easier. I could get a driver to keep from having to drive all the different places by myself. I was able to do many things that I hadn't been able to do prior to that.
In the 1950s, you toured on a black music circuit. And you weren't crossing over, even into the early 60s, to white audiences the way other African-American performers who were playing more rock and roll had started to do. Chuck Berry, Little Richard. Did you want to cross over? Were you frustrated that you weren't crossing over?
Well, in the beginning, I was really confused about the way the politics ran. And music, I always thought if you made a good record, it was a good record. If it was a hit record, it was a hit record. And people, not black, not white, red or yellow, but people would like it. Some people would like it. But I learned quickly after I got into the music business that there are so many categories. I was not really wanting to be a crossover, actually, but I wanted all people to hear it and like it. I was hoping, rather, they would like it. And people like Ray Charles, people like Chuck Berry, all these guys to me were very talented, and they was very energetic, Lloyd Price and so on. All of them was very energetic when it come to playing music. They didn't play the slow, droopy drawers music like I did, so I found that maybe that was my reason, because they had things that I didn't have, other way musically or entertaining.
In the mid-60s, I guess it was, a lot of the rock guitarists started emulating you. I mean, you became a god to some of them. Mike Bloomfield, Eric Clapton. And that helped introduce your music to college audiences. And then you started playing the college circuit, in addition to the places you'd already been playing. What was it like for you to start playing the college circuit? Did you feel like did it feel very different to you? Did you feel like you needed to change anything about your performance style? Was there anything you were doing that didn't seem to translate?
Yes, I was frightened at first. Here I am, a high school dropout, and I'm going to be playing to college audiences. Yes, I felt that I should wear a hard hat and be Fred Astaire or Nat Cole.
Be real suave.
Yeah. But I remember after 3 o'clock Blues, I had a manager, and he told me when I was going, it used to be a saying that for a black performer, it was four theaters you had to play and be accepted before you would be accepted as a true entertainer. One of those theaters was the Howard Theater in Washington, the Royal Theater in Baltimore, and the master itself was the Apollo Theater in New York, in Harlem. By the way, the fourth theater was the Regal Theater here in Chicago. However, my manager said, do not go to New York trying to be Nat Cole or anybody else that's trying to be slick, because there are people that sweep in the floors that are much better than you'll ever be. So the best thing for you to do is go there and be B.B. King.
What good advice.
Sing 3 o'clock blues. Mm-hmm. Sing the song that you sing the way you sing them. He said, now, all these other people can do all of those other things, but they can't be you as you can be you. And that I've tried to keep from then until now.
One of your recordings that I particularly love happens to be a recording with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Your recording of Don't Get Around Much Anymore.
Right.
I mean, gee, you don't even play guitar on this. It's so strange. It's such a unusual recording. I had a feel of singing with the Ellington Orchestra.
Frightening.
And not have a guitar. I mean, I don't think
you're
playing.
Well, I was afraid to try to sing, and trying to play guitar would have been just too much. But today, I'm more familiar with a lot of the standard tunes, and I would like to try and play the melodies instead of singing them.
Saturday dance, I heard they crowded the floor. It's awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore. I thought I'd visit the club. Got as far as the door. I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore. Darling, I guess my mind is more at ease. But nevertheless, why stir up memories, been invited on dates. I might have gone, but what for? I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore.
I have met over the years a lot of people who've worked with you or toured with you, and it's just not possible, I think, to get anybody to say a bad word about you. I mean, your reputation is of somebody who treats everybody around him really well, with a lot of respect, always fair, financially and in all other ways as well. And I'm just wondering if that's something that you consciously set out to do, I'm not just trying to be nice here. I mean, I think it's just a kind of a fact that you're known for this. I wonder if you think of yourself just naturally Mr. Nice Guy, or if it's something that you've felt really obliged to do and have been very conscious about doing.
There are some things that I've read that I truly believe in. I believe that one should treat others as they want to be treated. And that's one of the things that I try to live by, if you will, is trying to be fair to people as I want them to be to me.
B.B. King, it's really been such a delight to talk with you. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. You're very kind to talk with. I enjoy your voice.
B.B. King, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. The B.B. King Museum and Delta Interpretive Center opens this weekend in his hometown, Indianola, Mississippi.